Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy Goodman-Torpy.
And I'm Pete Torpy.
This week and every week, we'll start the show with a tip of the week and then get into the body of the program. This week, our theme is education. We'll be talking about what kind of accessibility services are available at schools, colleges, universities, and even public libraries. We've got a great interview about getting through school with a visual impairment with a real expert on the subject, a current student. And then we'll talk about Wikipedia, which is a free research tool that you can use on the web. So this week's tip of the week is talk to your teachers ahead of time if you're going to be taking a class to let them know what you need. Often, you'll be the first visually impaired student each teacher has had. So this tip applies outside of academics as well. You know, if you get a new boss, you get a new coworker, you make a new friend. So even if you're not in school or thinking of going to school, this might include some interesting tips for you. So Pete, when you were in school, what kind of special arrangements did you make with your new teachers for each class?
Well, as you pointed out, I mean, people are often willing to help if they know how to help. And so I'd always make it a point to speak to people ahead of time before a class and see what kind of accommodations needed to be made and what we could work out. So the first thing I would ask a professor is to verbalize what they wrote on the board. So I had a hard time, you know, when I was in high school, I had a little monocular. I could look at the board, but it was difficult, and it was easier if they spoke what was on the board. And then when I was in graduate school, I couldn't see at all what was on the board. So I asked people to just verbalize what they wrote. Now, most people were pretty accommodating about that, but again, sometimes you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I had a professor in quantum mechanics who would be writing some equations on the board, and he'd eventually say, well, you take this equation here, put it in that equation over there, and then substitute this variable. And I'd raise my hand, and I'd say, well, what was that again? You know, I couldn't see that. And, you know, he'd kind of forget who he was talking to, and he'd say, you take this equation over here and put this equation over there and put in this variable. So it didn't always work, but we tried.
Well, and even if the professor in question had read all of the equations, if you've ever tried reading an equation, it isn't easy until you've had a lot of practice at it.
The other thing I would do in classes like that was sometimes I would borrow notes from a friend who I knew might be a good note taker, so I could copy the notes, read them over later on, because again, it was difficult for me to copy everything that was on the board and that was going on, or even get the professor's notes. Sometimes the professors, if there wasn't a book for the class that I could follow along on in graduate school, they were willing to give me their notes, and I could copy from those.
So, what did you do about taking tests?
Well, sometimes I needed special arrangements for taking tests. For instance, when I was in graduate school, I needed to work with a CCTV. And back then, the CCTVs were very large and bulky. So I had one of those in my office, and we always made arrangements that they would give me the written test, and I would do it in my office and just be good about timing myself and being honest. The other important thing is to get some of your books ahead of time, to make sure that if you needed special books, for instance, before I could use the CCTV, I used recorded books. So I always asked what these books were I was going to use for a course ahead of time. And if they weren't available from certain sources, you could actually send book requests to RFB&D, Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, and they would record the books for you. So those were my first books through graduate school.
And like I said, reading equations isn't easy, but his classmates learned how to do that. And that was really a fabulous service that they were doing for him. Reading a physics textbook is a big deal.
They realized how difficult it was. A lot of my colleagues in graduate school, when my recorded books didn't come in initially, they offered to read for me, and they found out quite how difficult it was. It takes a little training to read equations.
So there's been an awful lot of changes in technology in the years since we were in school. You know, Pete had friends reading books. RFB&D had humans reading books. These days, there's an awful lot of technical equipment available. That's one of the reasons we're making this show. And you can get hold of this equipment at colleges, universities, public libraries. I'm going to read a little bit about the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is often referred to as the Civil Rights Act for People with Disabilities, which states that no otherwise qualified handicapped individual shall solely by reason of his or her handicap be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. And in order to comply with this mandate, colleges and universities that receive federal assistance must assure that the same educational programs and services are offered to every student, independent of whether they have a disability. And so you'll find at pretty much every college and university, unless it doesn't get federal funds, which I don't know about any of those, that they've got all sorts of programs and equipment. We've actually become more familiar with a few for various reasons. One day we were hanging around at the University of Maryland while our daughter was thinking about interviewing there. And we wandered into the library because it was hot out and just kind of tripped on their adaptive technology lab. And they had all sorts of equipment in there.
Yeah, it was cool in several ways. It kept us away from the heat. Actually, when I was in undergraduate school, those things just didn't exist. The people weren't so sensitive to different accessibility aids for people. So most of that you had to do on your own. So it's nice that colleges are accommodating the different disabilities and ways of doing business.
Right, and they had computers with speech interaction on them.
Right.
They had scanners. They had CCTVs. They had all sorts of equipment just in this lab waiting for any student who needed it to come use it. Other universities, such as Drexel, where our son just graduated from, has an Office of Disability Services that has various adaptive technology programs as appropriate. They'll make whatever accommodations are necessary to qualified students with disabilities. University of Rochester is in our hometown, so we went on their website to see what they have. They have something they call the Learning Assistance Center. So this is actually interesting. It's not just for people with physical disabilities, also for people with learning disabilities, or even for students who just need some help with their study skills. You know, any kind of assistance that you need to help you get through school, you're smart enough to do the work, but you might need some kind of assistance. They're there to provide it.
In fact, our daughter used to volunteer, or actually she got paid, I guess, when she was in college at Wesleyan. She used to
Wesleyan in Connecticut.
Right. She used to work at one of the school departments like that to help other people who had issues writing papers, and she would help correct them, help make them better and stuff like that. So these services are accessible to a wide range of people.
Right. In fact, when I went to look at the University of Rochester's link, the first thing I got was a list of suggestions and advice for faculty members who have visually impaired students in their classes. So to help them know up front the kinds of things that Pete had to ask each of his teachers for. And then at Rundell, there's actually a blind and visually impaired resource center on the lower level of the main building. So this is the Rochester Central Public Library. And they've got CCTVs, they've got described video service videos. They've got screen readers. They happen to have JAWS, but maybe they've got other brands as well. There's 20,000 titles in large print. They've got screen magnifying programs on their computers. And of course, they're our local hub for the talking book program through the state library.
But many librarians are familiar with large print, accessibility, different ways, you know, audio, video, different ways of getting material. So you should ask your reference librarian in your town for those services.
And reference librarians know an awful lot. They're wonderful people.
You are listening to Viewpoint.
This week's focus topic is getting through school with a visual impairment. For this segment, we decided to consult an expert. And who would know more about this topic than a current student? What follows is an interview with a 16-year-old high school student named Rebecca. So to help clarify some points in the interview, we need to explain some of her situation. First of all, she's in her local public high school in what's called an international baccalaureate program. Basically, she's an advanced everything. In addition, she participates in regional science fairs and other science competitions at the highest levels available in high school. Moreover, she's attended several summer science programs, which are all very exclusive and difficult to get into, and only one of which was geared to visually impaired students. students. So she's been around the country going to these science camps by herself. And she also attends occasional weekend programs for high school students at the Perkins School for the Blind in a suburb of Boston. We conducted this interview using Skype, as we did our previous interview on meeting and dating. And so it'll sound a little bit different. And here she is.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your vision problems.
I have a genetic disorder called congenital stationary night blindness. Because of my visual impairment, I have a couple of different aspects of my vision are affected. The main one is that if the lights are low or there's minimal light, I can't see anything. I go completely blind. I also have problems with my peripheral vision. I don't have that much. And I have problems with distance vision and reading. I read large print and braille.
What particular accommodations have you had to make or have others had to make for your classes and your education?
There are actually a bunch. And believe it or not, we kind of found them all through trial and error. There wasn't really at the beginning a solid test or assessment that said, okay, well, this is exactly what you need. You know, as I had problems in classes, we kind of had to brainstorm on the spot what to do about it. The first thing that's universal in every class is I read large print and I have a laptop with me all the time. So I type my notes, I get things scanned to me or emailed to me. And it's really helpful that my school has Wi-Fi now. So now I can take tests on the computer because the teacher can just send it to me and then I can edit it to put in my answers and send it back to them. Technology is great. I'm in the process of learning Braille. I found, especially after I went to a space camp program for kids with visual impairments, and I found how useful it would be, especially since I get really fatigued easily. And the classes I'm taking are very high demand and they require a lot of reading. Also, when I'm in class, I always sit in the front and the center. And my teachers, they're also asked to write in dark colors, preferably black or blue or purple. The technology also helps because all of my classes have smart boards, so they can print out the notes for me, so everything is high contrast and easy to see. I also use, in some classes, especially like during science labs, like my physics labs, I bring in a CCTV. I use it to read textbooks at home, too. But especially during labs, when I want to do a lot of the measurements myself and try to do as much of the lab as I can, I'll put, like, the experiment under the CCTV. And I actually ended up liking the one with the camera on the side. I also use a portable CCTV, which is like a handheld device where the camera is underneath it and the screen is, I guess, the size of your hand. And that I like using, especially when I'm not in the classroom and I'm like going to other places. As I do, I get to compete in other competitions because I'm really interested in science. So when I go there, they don't necessarily have the materials adapted for me. Actually, most of them say, what are you talking about, a visually impaired student here? But, you know, it's a new thing for them. But that portable CCTV opens up so many new doors for me because I've never been able to read, like, the students' abstracts when I go to science fair. So I really like being able to do that.
It sounds like it's important for you to understand what technologies and assistive aids might be useful for you. Where do you find out about these devices?
I have a vision teacher that comes about once a week, and one of the things that we like to do a lot is we go on the internet and we just start looking at new devices that I can possibly use. My school is a great resource, and the organization, BOCES, that she comes through is also a great resource, and they're really, as long as we order it in a little bit advance, they're really willing to let us try out new devices.
So you also mentioned that the other kids stand up for you, you know, if the teacher's marker starts to fade. What else do some of the other students do?
Well, there are different types of students. And I definitely learned this. It's been an interesting experience, especially since I do get to not only experience interacting with other students in my own school, but when I go compete at competitions, my friends are the most knowledgeable about what my vision is and what I can see. So they're probably more likely to point something out to me and make you know, they're concerned about my safety. There's also the other end of the spectrum where, you know, I've been in my school for 2.5 years and there are kids who still jump over my cane and step on it.
What is the reaction of some of your teachers to having a visually impaired person in their class?
Once again, definitely mixed, but it's also mixed with people. What I do is every summer, I've now sent out an email, you know, about 2 weeks before school starts. And I said, hi, my name, you know, I introduce myself. I say, and this is my visual impairment. I explain as much as I can in terms of how much I can see and how it's going to affect their class and what's really important for them to know. Because on the first day, it's hard to give such, you know, give such a long speech and explanation that, you know, I'm just excited to go to all my other classes as everyone else, and staying after class isn't that much fun on the first day. And also what accommodations are made in the classroom to, you know, so I can get around it. Most teachers, I get responses, oh, I'm so excited. Do I actually know what they think? probably not. But I think for them, it's probably very nerve-wracking. You know, there are so many people in my building, you know, my school, who are supportive of me and want to see me be able to do as much as they can. So we all work really hard to make the accommodations and allow me to do it. I really, truly can say that I can pretty much, you know, they've made it so I can pretty much do anything in my school. I don't think I've ever had a teacher who was unwilling to help me out.
Were there any teachers in particular who've been special to you?
About the second week of school, my biology teacher, who's become my mentor for the past 2.5 years, she kind of recognized, she's like, you're really smart, and do you want to do research on your visual impairment? Which to some people is like, oh, you know, they just want you to get involved. But to me, you know, she recognized something really important, was that the potential that I thought I had, you know, I didn't perceive that the correct way. You know, instead of viewing myself as someone who is just as able or more able than anyone else, you know, I kind of let my visual impairment get to me. And, you know, when she asked me that, I grew up a lot because I realized that, you know, I had as much potential as I saw myself to be. And, you know, it didn't matter what I could see or what I could do, and I was capable of anything. To this day, I am still I'm an active research student, and I'm, you know, I get tons of opportunities to meet different people from all over the world. I meet other people, and I think about, like, how much that one person changed my life. And going through school, probably one of the biggest things I've learned is that you can't just assume that everyone's going to perceive you in one way. Every kid faces the issue of how are they going to think of, you know, what I look and, you know, how I act and how am I going to make friends. And the biggest thing I was like, well, no one else has to deal with how are they going to think of, you know, me with a visual impairment. And, you know, the ability to face it in high school and embrace it and, you know, make something awesome out of it was probably, you know, it's one of the most memorable stories I always tell people, because that teacher, she not only changed my life and helped me to move in a direction that, you know, it determines, you know, what I want to be when I grow up. And it kind of gave me this new passion for science, but it also shows that it taught me that I could give myself a chance and help me to get to where I am today.
You know, I think with or without a visual impairment, it's really important for every student to have somebody besides yourself and your parents, you know, who kind of have to believe in you, to have somebody else out there who believes in you and believes in your abilities. And, you know, maybe you're a little bit unusual. So for you, it's because you have a visual impairment. I mean, I'm a lot older, and when I was your age, there weren't girls going into science, but I had a couple of teachers who believed in me, and it made a world of difference.
It sounds like you must also have very supportive parents to offer you the opportunities and support and let you go where you needed to go.
Yeah, my parents are the absolute best. I mean, I'm going to say this, but they're the best parents in the world. They pretty much told me that I could do anything I wanted. And nothing, you know, my visual impairment, it doesn't matter. And no, I mentioned I'm going skiing tomorrow, which is really cool, because people say, what do you mean? How do you ski? You know, you can't walk down the hallway, which is, you know, you get a laugh out of it. But, you know, they've given me the opportunities. They've allowed me to try adaptive skiing, make it work. If there was something that we were unsure about that maybe I couldn't do because I was visually impaired, they made it happen. One thing that, you know, is a recent challenge, because I'm 16, that everyone's getting their driver's permit, you know, and that's something that I was like, oh, I can't believe, you know, I can't drive to school when I'm a senior, you know, and that's been particularly hard for me, but, you know, they've, like, made it so I can get to school. Like, they drive me to school every morning and probably pick me up almost every day, because they know, like, there's a difference between someone picking you up and taking the bus, and, like, that just means the world. And my parents' support, I couldn't have done it. My mom and my dad are incredible advocates in getting accommodations for me. It's because my situation is so new going through school. A lot of the administrators who are dealing with it, it's new territory. So there are new rules that are made because, I have a laptop in school. What type of internet access can I get, et cetera. And, you know, between my mom and also my vision teacher, who we've worked with for about 5 years now, there are accommodations I have because they called and they emailed and they were so persistent and made sure that I had what I needed in class to get the work done and get it done just, you know, the same as everyone else.
So what are some of your plans for the future as you go through high school and after high school?
As I mentioned, I am a science research student. My passion is science. There's no doubt about that. I love it more than anything, and I love doing different things associated with it. One of the main things, that project that I'm working on is working on better ways to diagnose and treat different types of visual and hearing disorders, and that's really close to me. So my goal is to become a doctor. I know I can't become a practicing doctor, but I love research, so I definitely want to do an MD PhD program, you know, go through college and go through med school. I got to meet some people and talk about the med school. You know, why would I go through it if I couldn't become a practicing doctor? But, you know, I love the biology and I love learning, and I think it's going to be cool. You know, I hope it's going to be a cool experience. You know, people say, what do you mean you want to be a doctor? How can you do that? And to me, it's the challenge. You know, I'm up for the challenge. I'm ready for it. And, I'm going to do as much as I can to hopefully get there, you know, in the best way possible.
What a girl. She's definitely determined and already has a track record of overcoming obstacles. We told her that if we're still doing this show in enough years, we'll interview her again as she goes through college and graduate school. Now, of course, when Pete was in high school 40 years ago, many of the tools Rebecca uses daily hadn't been invented yet, but many of his experiences paralleled hers. So, Pete, can you discuss some of your educational experiences?
Well, when I was young, they did not mainstream children into public schools. So I actually went to a school for the blind when I lived in New York City until I was in fifth grade. But then when my folks moved to Long Island, that was too far away and I didn't want to live there. So we tried public school, and that worked out quite well. But again, we always talked to the teachers. I was able to see enough at the time that I held a little handheld telescope, as I mentioned earlier in the program, to see the blackboard. And basically, I saw enough that I just looked very close at things. I mean, I took books, right up to my nose and read them and stuff like that. By the time I got to college, my eyesight was a little bit more of a problem, and there were good days and bad days, and I had to schedule my work. Some days I wasn't able to work, and I just had to be efficient when my eyes were cooperating. By the time I got to graduate school, I was totally blind for the first 6 months, and then I used a lot of the methods we talked about earlier, talking to the professors that I was going to have for my classes ahead of time so we can make special accommodations to take the tests. I found out ahead of time what my books were going to be and got them all recorded by Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic. At the time, they didn't have a lot of quantum mechanics books when I was going into physics, so that had to be done maybe 6 months in advance, and I had some of my colleagues help read books to me while I was waiting for those books to arrive. Later on in graduate school, I was able to use a CCTV, and we talked about some of the accommodations about test-taking that were made back then. And so that's how I made it through graduate school, just by talking to people and working with these different technologies.
Now for this week's high-tech item, Wikipedia. You might have heard news stories recently about Wikipedia celebrating its 10th anniversary in January 2011. However, you might not know yet what all the hype is about. Well, for one thing, it's about something that's grown really, really fast and become really, really big. When it was new 10 years ago and our kids were in high school, they weren't even allowed to cite articles from Wikipedia in their papers because it was viewed with a lot of suspicion. But now many people refer to Wikipedia first for an overview of any topic, and citations have a lot more credibility than they used to. In the 10 years since it was developed, it's grown rapidly into one of the largest reference websites. And of course, I'm quoting directly from Wikipedia. Where would you get information about Wikipedia but Wikipedia?
That's a good place.
I thought so. They have 78 million visitors a month. There are over 91,000 active contributors working on 17 million articles in over 270 languages. I didn't even know there were 270 languages. As of today, there are over 3.5 million articles just in English. And they, you know, they've got them in 270 other languages, too. And every day, hundreds of thousands of visitors from around the world collectively make tens of thousands of edits and create thousands of new articles to augment the knowledge held by the Wikipedia Encyclopedia.
One of the interesting things is they only have a few tens of employees. So they get all this work done essentially with everybody cooperatively helping and keeping these sites up to date and corrected and informative.
So if you want to get into Wikipedia, you go to EN, that's short for English, dot Wikipedia, W-I-K-I-P-E-D-I-A, dot org. And that'll take you directly into the English version of Wikipedia. And so how would you use it from there if you can't see, Pete?
Oh, well, nicely, these sites, Wikipedia sites, are very well organized with headings and lists and tables that are marked up with the proper HTML, and it makes it very easy to navigate with a screen reader. So I often navigate by heading. In JAWS, you can hit H to go to the next heading, the next major topic. You can hit L to go to a list and T to a table. So it makes it very easy to get through that. And all the links are properly labeled and stuff.
That's it for this week's show. Next week on Viewpoints, our theme will be driving for the non-driver. You heard that correctly.
Oh, I'm waiting for that.
Right. Well, there's a lot of organizations working on developing vehicles that can be driven without a sighted driver. But we'll also have tips about things, useful things a blind passenger can do, and some information about GPSs that use speech input and speech output. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to reachout@wxxi.org or call us at area code 585-258-0333. We'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. This program was hosted by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey. We hope you'll join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show by going to our website at wxxi.org/reachout and clicking on the podcast's link. Thanks for listening to Viewpoints, and have a nice day.